quite know exactly what their individual roles were. We may learn quite a bit more about that in the final report coming out from the committee tomorrow.
And we'll talk more about that in the coming days on Democracy Now! Finally, Ruth Ben-Ghiat, again, President Trump has not been charged. The House will now switch to be Republican-led, but the Justice Department doesn't change. Can you explain what happens next?
I'm not a legal expert, but, you know, one thing that came out yesterday, which is so important for democracy prevention, is that the only reason that Jeffrey Clark was not appointed, and this is what autocrats do, they politicize justice, they put loyalists in there, was that there was mass resignations threatened by DOJ employees. And this assertion of professional ethics is itself a form of democracy prevention. And so civil service, some people think, oh, it's boring, the civil service. But it's absolutely essential because these are the people whose individual actions add up to, in this case, added up to a block on an autocratic move. So the culture of the DOJ is very important. And so we'll see what they choose to do.
Ruth Ben-Ghiat, we want to thank you for being with us, a historian, professor of history at New York University, author of the book Strongmen, Mussolini to the Present, and Robert Weissman, president of Public Citizen. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are tuned to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programmings of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website, kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing, unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Governance and Policy Committee meets quarterly on the third Tuesday of March, June, September, and December at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify that a meeting is being held.
Coming up this Monday at 2 p.m. on December 26th, Boxing Day, the Monday Sampler will present a special Christmas-themed adventure of the greatest detective in the world, Sherlock Holmes, narrated by his good friend, Dr. John Watson.
Holmes always called it the adventure of the Christmas bride. It concerns a ghostly lady in white who was supposed to have disappeared centuries ago. The honor of a noble family and a certain Father Christmas who suddenly sank base.
The game will have found its feet again this Monday as the Monday Sampler presents The Adventure of the Christmas Bride. With John Stanley as Sherlock Holmes and Alfred Shirley as Dr. John Watson. And we'll also have a lot of music. So tune in right here on Community Radio, KBOO Portland, for the Monday Sampler this Monday at 2 p.m.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this end-of-the-year fun drive edition of the KBOO Evening News, a Portland police officer won't face charges for fatally shooting a member of the public in July. Harvey Weinstein is convicted of more assault charges in California. And in international news, the Taliban bans women from higher education in Afghanistan. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, December 20th, 2022. KBOO is currently in our end-of-the-year fundraising drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Eric Leuschner. Portland police officer John Dyke will not be charged in the shooting death of Portlander Aaron Stanton this July. That's the result of a Multnomah County jury decision Tuesday. Dyke was part of a Focused Intervention Team, which is supposed to address gun violence. Stanton was allegedly shooting a gun in the air when police were called. Dyke fatally shot Stanton soon after they arrived. The jury found that shooting Stanton was allowed by an Oregon law that protects officers' ability to shoot in defense of themselves or others. Dyke will be back on the force. He has been on administrative leave since July. Stanton was the third person killed by Portland police in 2022. That total is now four. Portland reports 67 traffic deaths so far in 2022, matching the total the city reached in 2021, with 2 weeks until the end of the year. Pedestrian fatalities are at a 70-year high, with 32 of the reported deaths being folks walking down the street. The police bureau is asking drivers to be extra careful in the wet and icy weather in store for the last week of December. Elsewhere in car news, the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality voted on Monday to ban the sale of new gas-powered cars in the state by 2035. Hybrid cars can still be sold, but the ban is meant to help Oregon reach its 90% carbon emissions cut by 2050. 40% of all carbon emissions come from the transportation sector. The January 6th committee voted to refer Trump and others on criminal charges to the Justice Department in their final meeting yesterday. With more on the story, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Every president in our history has defended this orderly transfer of authority, except one.
The January 6th subcommittee voted unanimously to send criminal referrals of former President Donald Trump and several Trump administration officials to the U.S. Justice Department. The committee is urging the DOJ to consider charging Trump with conspiracy to defraud the federal government, obstruction of an official proceeding, Congress's certification of electoral votes, conspiracy to make a false statement, and inciting or assisting those in an insurrection. A criminal referral is also being made for John Eastman, the lawyer who the committee notes was the architect of the plan to pressure former Vice President Mike Pence to reject states' electoral votes on January 6th and have fake electors submitted to the Congress instead. U.S. Capitol Police Chief Tom Manger testified before the Senate Rules and Administration Committee about his work over the last year implementing new safety recommendations to keep lawmakers safe since the January 6th attack on the Capitol.
The department identified, prioritized, and remediated the most significant gaps, including those identified by this committee, such as developing department-wide operational plans for special events, training and equipping the Civil Disturbance Unit, and improving the department's intelligence gathering and sharing capabilities.
As the 117th Congress prepares to leave for the Christmas break, the 118th Congress, with a Republican-controlled House, will take the reins in 2023. There are concerns different pieces of legislation might get bogged down in partisan arguments, especially as Republicans have said they'll conduct investigations into both the Biden family and administration. Tevi Troy, a senior fellow at the Bipartisan Policy Center, gave an example of what bipartisanship looked like.
Well, I always like to look at people like Orrin Hatch, who just died in the last year, and Ted Kennedy. Orrin Hatch was a conservative and a solid conservative, and Ted Kennedy, he was obviously liberal, but they found ways to work together because they knew that if they didn't work together, things would not get done.
Congress passed a short-term continuing resolution that is set to expire this week. Representative Richie Torres of New York describes his hopes for the budget process.
We have to keep the government open. We have to prevent a government shutdown. And the overriding priority moving forward is to ensure that we pass an omnibus rather than a full-year continuing resolution, which would cause the government to be open, but it would cause the government to be chronically underfunded.
The Supreme Court has delayed lifting Title 42, an order that allowed authorities to swiftly expel migrants at U.S. land borders to slow the spread of COVID-19. Title 42 was set to expire on December 21st, but Chief Justice John Roberts stayed a lower court's ruling in response to a petition from several Republican-led states. While the Biden administration has been making preparations for migrants coming to the border, there's bipartisan doubt over the administration's plans. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
A Los Angeles jury found Harvey Weinstein guilty of rape yesterday. The verdict comes while Weinstein serves a 23-year prison sentence in New York for other rape convictions. He is scheduled to be sentenced in the Los Angeles case early next year but must complete his current prison sentence before being transferred to California. California jurors deliberated for more than 9 days before convicting Weinstein of forcible rape, forcible oral copulation, and sexual penetration by a foreign object. The charges were based on statements by a woman who accused Weinstein of attacking her in a Beverly Hills hotel room in 2013. The woman said in a statement, quote, "Harvey Weinstein forever destroyed a part of me that night. I will never get that back, but I knew I had to see this through to the end. I hope Weinstein never sees the outside of a prison cell during his lifetime," end quote. A jury either acquitted Weinstein or could not reach a verdict on additional charges he raped or assaulted three other women in Beverly Hills hotel rooms between 2004 and 2013. Los Angeles County Superior Court Judge Lisa Lynch declared a mistrial on the deadlocked charges, and the Los Angeles County District Attorney has not decided whether or not to retry Weinstein. Weinstein faces up to 18 years in prison, though the jury could cite aggravating factors and extend the sentence by 6 more years. More than 100 women have accused Weinstein of sexual misconduct since 2017. Previous articles in the New York Times and the New Yorker detailing sexual misconduct allegations against him helped spark the Me Too movement. He allegedly used the promise of career advancement to get women alone, and after an assault, did offer some film roles. Some feel the offers were made to make it appear the women willingly traded sex for professional help. Weinstein's defense attorneys have argued that many of the women were opportunists, depicting what had been classic consensual casting couch relationships as rape. The Los Angeles results could prove critical if Weinstein wins an appeal of his New York conviction next year. It now seems very likely Weinstein will spend the rest of his life behind bars. An award for outstanding volunteers has gone to an Oregon woman who helps people with low incomes and older Oregonians prepare their taxes. Oregonians volunteer at one of the highest rates in the country. Eric Tegedoff has more.
An Oregon woman who helps people with their taxes has won a prestigious award for volunteers. AARP Oregon has awarded the 2022 Andrus Award for Community Service to Kathy Gettle, a volunteer who has worked with the AARP Tax Aid Program for 3 decades. The program helps people with low incomes and older Oregonians prepare their tax returns for free each year. Michael Schultz is state volunteer president for AARP Oregon.
Having met Kathy on several occasions, I've just been very impressed with how she motivates people by her example as a lead volunteer, and she's always the first to step forward to get things done.
About 43% of Oregonians volunteer, according to AmeriCorps, which is the third highest rate in the country. The annual value of Oregonians' volunteer service is estimated at $4.2 billion. Schultz says he's worked in the nonprofit sector and knows volunteers are a critical piece of their work.
Volunteers are the authentic voice of what we're trying to achieve with our mission and vision. They have the stories to tell that staff can't tell, but the volunteer can tell.
The Andrus Award for Community Service is named after AARP founder Dr. Ethel Percy Andrus. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The Taliban government has suspended university education for all female students in Afghanistan. A letter published by the Afghan Ministry of Higher Education said the decision was made in a cabinet meeting and that the order will go into effect immediately. The Taliban took over the Afghan government in August of 2021. They imposed a 7-month ban on girls attending secondary schools. Then, hours before schools were finally due to open, the Taliban reversed this decision. They announced that girls' secondary schools were to remain closed indefinitely. That is, until they put in place policies compliant with, quote, principles of Islamic law and Afghan culture, end quote, including further restrictions on schoolgirls' dress. Human Rights Watch criticized the ban, calling it a shameful decision that violates the rights to education for women and girls in Afghanistan. They added, quote, "The Taliban are making it clear every day that they don't respect the fundamental rights of Afghans, especially women," end quote. After seizing power in Afghanistan last year, the Taliban briefly attempted to project a more moderate image, apparently to gain international support. However, While it has made numerous promises that it would protect women, the Taliban has systematically clamped down on their rights and freedoms. Women in Afghanistan can no longer work in most sectors and require a male guardian for long-distance travel. The Taliban has also ordered them to cover their faces in public. You're listening to an end-of-the-year fun drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on a call from local environmental activists to Multnomah County to restrict methane gas appliances in homes. Then, Noise Filter, your public health podcast. At 6, it's Transpositive PDX. Then at 7, For the Wild. Tonight's weather, we'll see some clouds and scattered showers with an overnight low of 35 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be cloudy and a high of 38 degrees. Today in history is International Human Solidarity Day, as declared in 2005 by the United Nations. Its goal is to recognize the importance of international solidarity in the fight to end global poverty. The quote of the day is from American author John Steinbeck, who died this day in 1968. He said, quote, "Power does not corrupt, fear corrupts. Perhaps the fear of losing power," end quote. A new study shows kids in childcare are not more likely to exhibit behavior problems versus other children. The data included research from five nations over nearly 20 years. Brett Pivato has more in Maryland.
New research shows kids in childcare aren't more likely to exhibit behavior problems than other children. The study, published in the journal Child Development, looked at data from seven studies, including more than 10,000 toddlers and preschoolers in five nations. Researchers looked at the number of hours per week children were in care settings and reported they found no greater likelihood of problem behaviors such as hitting, kicking, biting, fighting, or bullying with a greater quantity of time spent in care. Doug Lent with the nonprofit Maryland Family Network says quality is the most important consideration for parents when looking for child care.
In a quality child care setting, a child care provider knows how to address some of the aggressive behaviors. They've attended in Maryland at least 90 hours of early childhood education training, and they're familiar with what's healthy, what's not, and where to go for help if a child is acting out.
The study looked at existing research compiled between 1993 and 2012 in Germany, the Netherlands, Norway, Canada, and the United States. Accessing high-quality child care in the other countries in the study is comparatively easy versus the U.S. The EU average expenditure is around $6,000 per child, with the U.S. spending about half that, and Lent says we should be doing more.
In an ideal world, every parent who needs it in the United States would have access to high-quality child care. And we can do that by expanding the existing child care scholarship fund, which we have done successfully here in Maryland, and expanding pre-K to more families would go a long way to making that care accessible to more families.
The Maryland Child care scholarship income limits were increased in 2022 such that now a family of four earning $90,000 a year can still qualify for help. Maryland Family Networks can help with a child care scholarship application at no cost to parents. Lent says another service they provide is called Locate Child Care, which, in addition to offering a list of quality care providers, assists parents in knowing what to look for.
We will spend as much time with parents as they need to, first of all, help them understand what to look for in a quality child care setting, what questions to ask that provider, and how to identify what's best for your child.
Find out more online at MarylandFamilyNetwork.org. For Maryland News Connection, I'm Brett Pivato.
Democrats have not performed well in rural parts of the country in recent decades, but there are success stories, including Montana State Representative-elect Paul Tuss. Eric Tegedoff explores why.
Democrats have struggled to turn red rural areas blue across the country for years, but some left-leaning candidates won in 2022, raising the question of how they succeeded where many others have failed. In Haver, Paul Tuss flipped a Montana Legislative House seat in an area where President Joe Biden only received about 40% of the vote. Lindsay Ratliff is chair of the Hill County Democrats Central Committee in the district.
We kept everything local, so every message was about a strong economy for the High Line, for our community, talking about public lands and infrastructure, all those things that affect every single person in our district.
Ratliff says there's also a big union presence in the region through the railroad, public schools, and health care. That helped with organizing efforts for Tuss, who serves on the local hospital board. While Tuss was able to flip the seat to Democrats, Republicans gained a legislative supermajority in the 2022 election. The Rural Urban Bridge Initiative released a report about the keys to success for Democrats in these areas. Group co-founder Anthony Flaccavento says one finding is that winning candidates were widely seen as engaged with the local community, whether they were fourth-generation residents or relative newcomers.
They had strong, what we call in the report, local fluency. They knew the community, they knew the history, they knew the language and the mores and the vernacular and all of that. They knew what mattered to the majority of people. And they, in one way or another, had been engaged with trying to make the community strong.
Ratliff says the other key to success for Democrats, or any candidate, is to knock on every door and go to every event they can.
That shows that we are here. We do care about our community members, whether they're Republican or Democrat, and don't be afraid to show up, because the people who show up are the ones that get elected.
For Big Sky Connection, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
An underwater drone has discovered an indigenous weir off the coast of Alaska. It was an ecologically sound and efficient way of catching fish. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. For thousands of years, indigenous peoples along the western coast of North America built stone weirs on beaches to trap fish on the incoming tide. It was an efficient way to catch them, but also ecologically sound. In southeast Alaska, sonar in 2010 spotted what looked like a structure underwater near Prince of Wales Island, one that a Canadian underwater archaeologist suspected was a weir. This year, a team of scientists got a closer look with an underwater drone and confirmed Dr. Kelly Monteleone's theory that the arc of stacked boulders was indeed a weir. Monteleone teaches anthropology and archaeology at the University of Calgary and presented her findings in Juneau recently at the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute, one of the partners in the project. She says the weir is at least 11,000 years old and perhaps one of the oldest in the world.
This means that they had those patterns 11,000 years ago, which means they were here so much longer.
Monteleone says the presence of the weir suggests the land was in use 5,000 years earlier. The fact that it was underwater also points to a drastic change in sea level in a very short period of time.
Does that mean that with this level of sea level rise, change became the new normal?
That's a question scientists want to know more about. They say knowledge about how people adapted to drastic changes in sea levels 11,000 years ago could be helpful to Alaska Native people today as they cope with climate change. The project has adopted what a Mi'kmaq elder has described as two-eye seeing.
The idea is with two-eyed seeing is that you're able to look at both an indigenous lens or viewpoint and a Western scientific viewpoint at the same time.
Monteleone says her research incorporates oral histories and traditional knowledge to get a more holistic look at the patterns of land use. The project is also part of Sea Alaska Heritage Institute's ongoing efforts to document the presence of indigenous peoples in southeast Alaska to strengthen their historic claim to the land. The Cherokee Nation is opening a new domestic violence shelter in Stillwell, Oklahoma, Tuesday to help families and children. The 11,000-square-foot shelter is set up to house up to six families and has an indoor child playroom. There will also be staff on site. Cherokee officials and members of the tribe's task force to protect women and families are unveiling new initiatives to address domestic violence on the Cherokee Nation Reservation in 2023. One of the initiatives includes a statewide intimate partner and family training summit scheduled for April. Cherokee Nation Principal Chief Chuck Hoskin Jr. says protecting families and children from violence is a priority, and the implementation of new initiatives is intended to make sweeping and lasting changes to keep the reservation safe. A Navajo veteran has been awarded a Purple Heart more than 50 years after being wounded in battle. Leroy Cody recently received the Purple Heart Medal during a ceremony in Lupa, Arizona. 56 years ago, he was wounded in battle in the Vietnam War. During the ceremony, the Military Order of the Purple Heart Department of Arizona also officially designated Lupa as a Purple Heart community. The community has three other Purple Heart recipients. Lupa now joins a national network of Purple Heart roads, bridges, highways, and monuments, honoring service members who have received the Purple Heart. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Widespread street protests in Iran continue under the banner Women, Life, Freedom. The protests were sparked in September after a 22-year-old woman, Mahsa Amini, was killed by the so-called morality police while in custody. Commentators have called it the largest threat to Iran since the Iran-Iraq War. Now we go to Global Citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertoff. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. Streets in dozens of Iran cities are filled with angry people in popular protests that have already gone on much longer, 3 months and counting, than those in 2009 and 2019. The unrest erupted when news broke on September 16 that a 22-year-old woman, Mahsa Amini, had died in the custody of the morality police after being accused of violating Iran's mandatory headscarf law. Large numbers of Iranians are calling for the ouster of the autocratic clerics who rule the country. Women, life, freedom is their cry, and the overthrow of the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei regime is their aim. The hardline president of Iran, Ebrahim Raisi, naturally dismisses the protesters, saying, "We have to separate between rightful protest and riots," adding that the Islamic Republic's red line is the lives of the people and their properties. But he surely knows, as one observer writes, that the demonstrations are the most serious threat to the Islamic Republic since the Iran-Iraq War of the 1980s. The regime's harsh response shows that it believes that assessment. According to human rights groups in Iran, about 18,000 people have been arrested and nearly 500 civilians have been killed. Two executions of protesters have occurred, with many more likely. The government's pattern is the same as in the past: direct assault on the protesters to clear the streets, including random firing into crowds. The supreme leader, the Ayatollah, has said nary a word in sympathy with those killed. The protests have come at the best of times and the worst of times. The best because the theocracy of Khamenei, who has ruled since 1989, is repugnant when it comes to women and respect for human rights in general. That same observer I quoted a moment ago cites the feminist character of the demonstrations, noting that the huge number of women are the protesters. These protests have been supported with audacious acts never before seen, such as hacking of state television, showing an image of Khamenei being devoured by flames, the Iran's national soccer team's refusal to sing the national anthem at the World Cup games in Qatar, and criticism of the regime by the Kurdish soccer player in Iran who was arrested. The protests deserve worldwide support, and to a large extent, they've received them from just about all democratic governments. The UN's Human Rights Council authorized creation of a fact-finding mechanism by a wide margin, 25-6, with 16 abstentions. The council's head, Volker Turk, said, quote, "We are now in a full-fledged human rights crisis." He appealed to Iran's government to acknowledge the deep-seated social, economic, and political grievances that have been building up, to heed people's demands for their rights to be protected and their voices to be heard, to acknowledge the legitimacy of those calling for a different vision of society. Women and girls must be able to feel free and secure in public without fear of violence and harassment. Young people need to know that they can peacefully express their opinions without fear of protest, of arrest, and imprisonment," unquote. Press reports say the regime will disband the morality police, but that's hard to believe. The Ayatollah surely is aware of the famous warning of Alexis de Tocqueville: "The most dangerous moment for a bad government is when it begins to reform itself." It's also the worst of times because U.S. support of the protesters, the remarkable bravery and courage that the Iranian people are exhibiting through their peaceful demonstrations, as a State Department spokesman put it, has national security consequences. It helps the regime justify Iran's shipment of drones to Russia and training for their use in the Ukraine war. U.S. support of the protests also puts the nuclear talks on the back burner, perhaps never to be revived. as Reuters reports on October 12, asked if the United States was interested in pursuing talks to revive the pact, he said, "That's not our focus right now. In fact, the nuclear talks are at an impasse, with one U.S. official calling them a waste of time since Tehran hasn't come up with any new proposals. To the contrary, as the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency has said, the Iranians were tripling, not merely doubling, their capacity to enrich uranium at 60%, a figure that gets Iran closer to the 90% enrichment needed for a nuclear weapon. And it also provides the U.S. with a convenient excuse for walking away from the table." The current situation marks yet another time in Iran that the U.S. has had to choose between supporting human rights or national security priorities. Barack Obama faced the same choice when deciding to go ahead with the nuclear deal in 2015. This time around, as the Biden administration watches Russia and China come to Khamenei's aid, the choice should be clear in favor of human rights. Restoring the nuclear deal will have to await Khamenei's successor. Thanks for listening. I'm Mel Gertov for The Global Citizen.
You're listening to an end-of-the-year fund drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, December 20th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Reed Johnson and Josh Salem. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonio Gonzalez, Edwin J. Vieira, Eric Tagadoff, and Brett Pivetto. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. KBOO is currently in our end-of-the-year fund drive, so now is a great time to get involved. If you would like to become a member and support